So for centuries, philosophers had questioned and pondered the nature of the soul. In an unusually elaborate argument, whose length shows the importance of the topic and the lively controversy that surrounded it, Thomas establishes that there is but one soul in man. The soul is the intellectual principle that distinguishes man from other animals. Through the soul, man lives and feels and has his being.
It must be said that the intellect, which is the principle of intellectual operation, is the form of the human body. For that whereby anything acts is, in the first place, a form of the thing to which the act belongs. Thus, that whereby a body is primarily healed is health, and that whereby the soul knows primarily is knowledge. Hence, health is a form of the body, and knowledge is a form of the soul.
As always, Thomas gives his reasons.
The reason for this is that nothing acts except so far as it is in act. And so, a thing acts by that whereby it is in act. Now, it is clear that by which the body lives is, in the first place, the soul. And as life manifests itself through various operations in different degrees of living things, that whereby we primarily perform each of all these vital actions is the soul. For the soul is the primary principle of our nourishment, sensations, and local movement, and likewise of our understanding. Therefore, this principle by which primarily we understand, whether it be called the intellect or the intellectual soul, is the form of the body. This is the demonstration used by Aristotle.
So the intellectual soul is the first and specific form of the human body. Thomas now considers the soul in itself. The human soul has a power that it exercises alone. This is the activity of understanding. Not only does this distinguish man from other animals, but it's an activity that a bodily organ can't perform. The body must always be located in this or that particular situation and be restricted by this or that set of definite conditions, circumstances. The body's nutritive and sensory powers are also restricted to a definite time and place. We see only as far as the horizon and from our own limited point of view. But in understanding, the mind is not confined in these ways. Of course, the human individual, body and soul, is the one who knows things. But he knows by transcending in time, place, and matter. Thomas says further,
"The human soul, by reason of its perfection, is not a form immersed in matter or entirely embraced by matter. The soul is separate according to its intellectual power, because an intellectual power is not the power of a corporeal organ, as the power of seeing is the act of the eye. For understanding is an act which cannot be performed by a corporeal organ, as can the act of seeing. Nevertheless, the soul exists in matter, insofar as the soul itself, to which this intellectual power belongs, is the form of the body."
To sum up how Thomas sees it, the soul is a non-material form of the body, and this soul can act through its own resources independently of the body. Over 1,500 years before Thomas, Plato had described an idea as a kind of form. Now Thomas has described the soul as the non-material form of the body. He goes on to say that forms in nature are found in various steps or grades.
"The nobler a form is, the more it dominates corporeal matter, the less it is immersed in matter, and the more it surpasses matter by its power and its operation. Hence, we find that the form of a compound has an operation different from that caused by its elements. And the higher we advance in the nobility of forms, the more we find that the power of the form surpasses the elementary matter, as the vegetative soul excels the mineral form, and the sensitive soul excels the vegetative soul. Now, the human soul is the highest and noblest of forms, and so, in its power, it surpasses corporeal matter by the fact that it has an operation and a power in which corporeal matter has no share whatever. This power is called the intellect."
The ladder of forms leads up from inorganic forms through the various kinds of souls and even beyond the intellectual soul. Each step moves away from the conditions of matter and more towards the freedom of spiritual being. We've seen that Thomas believes the essential nature of knowledge is to transcend the conditions of matter. Light, more light, the Greek hero is supposed to have cried, and Thomas takes up the cry. In an earlier part of the Summa, he asks whether there is knowledge in God. His answer tells us a good deal about what he takes to be the root character of knowledge.
Knowing beings are distinguished from non-knowing beings, in that the non-knowing possess only their own form, whereas the knowing being is naturally disposed to possess also the forms of other things. For the species or likeness of the thing known is in the knower. Hence it is manifest that the nature of a non-knowing being is more contracted and limited, whereas the nature of knowing beings has a greater amplitude and extension. That is why the philosopher says that the soul is, in a sense, all things. Now, the contraction of a form comes through the matter. Hence, according as they are the more immaterial, forms approach more nearly to a kind of infinity. Therefore, it is clear that the immateriality of a thing is the reason why it is cognitive, and the manner of cognition is proportioned to the mode of immateriality. Hence, it is said in Aristotle's book On the Soul that plants do not know because of their materiality, but sense is cognitive because it can receive species or images free from matter.
Thomas now reaches his point.
The human intellect is still further cognitive, because it is still more separated from matter and unmixed.
In brief, immateriality is the currency of knowledge, intelligence is its broker, and intelligible meanings are its coin. Turning back to the question, Thomas draws a conclusion about whether knowledge is in God.
Since, therefore, God is in the highest degree immaterial, it follows that he possesses the highest kind of knowledge.
Intellectual knowledge, then, is a sign of the spirituality that energizes the human center. But for Thomas, the human being is the lowliest of spiritual beings, a sort of suburban dweller among the community of spiritual beings, a rustic living on the border of time and eternity. The levels of physical reality in man are joined with the spiritual soul to form the unique human composite of matter and spirit.
Man, in a certain sense, contains all things. Now, we may consider four things in man. His reason, which makes him like to the angels. His sensitive powers, whereby he is like the animals. His natural powers, which liken him to the plants. And the body itself, wherein he is like to inanimate things.
Man's very complexity, however, removes him from the full actuality of spirit. For Thomas, human knowledge is relatively empty, but he doesn't agree with Plato that the soul knows things by remembering them from before birth. Thomas says the soul must learn from its situation in the human body. Nothing is known naturally unless it's drawn from experience. We must continually learn by looking, listening, feeling, remembering. This is what Thomas means when he says that the soul is in the body for the good of the soul and therefore for the good of the whole person.
If Plato were right, then the union of the soul and body would not be for the soul's good. It is clear that it was for the soul's good that it was united to a body and that it understands by turning to the phantasms. Nevertheless, it is possible for it to exist apart from the body, and also to understand in another way.
Thomas proves, to his satisfaction, that the soul survives death and the corruption of the body. Still, after death, the separated soul loses its ordinary powers, so that divine grace alone can come to the rescue. Indeed, Thomas's theology brightens the fate of the soul separated from its body, since it promises to fully restore the soul and body in the resurrected and transformed human being. Philosophy, on the other hand, has little to say about the state of the separated soul. Still, Thomas's philosophy does have something to say about the soul after death. He affirms that the soul survives, but his philosophy says little about what its condition is. By its nature, the soul has many powers. These include the vegetal powers of nutrition, growth, and excitation, and the animal powers of sensation, perception, memory, and imagination. But the soul exercises these powers by means of the body. Lacking bodily organs, they withdraw after death into a latent state within the soul. Thomas's philosophy also says the soul possesses the rational powers of understanding and choice. He takes as his principle the following maxim: operation follows upon being. In other words, the kind of activity that anything performs will tell you what manner of being it is. It follows, then, that if the soul can here and now transcend the bodily situation, then it exists right now with an active being that transcends the fate of the body. With this reasoning, Thomas arrives at his distinctive solution. The soul is not only the form of the human body, it is also a substance, something in its own right. But he adds, it's an incomplete substance. To be sure, Thomas says the soul continues to exist even after separation from the body because it is immaterial. The soul's immaterial because it can perform an action that transcends its material being. But the soul's natural state is to be united with the human body as its form. Apart from that union, the soul is incomplete. Thomas's solution satisfied neither side of the debate about the soul. Not the Platonists, who thought that the human soul is a complete substance without any essential connection with the body. Surely not the materialists, who thought the individual soul is merely an effluence of the body, without any independence from it. Among the materialists were philosophers who based their view on their understanding of certain Arabic thinkers. They argued that the individual human being was wholly material and mortal. When it was pointed out to the materialists that individual human beings transcend the mortality of their bodies whenever they arrive at objective knowledge, they replied that such knowledge does not belong to the individual at all. Rather, it belongs to a kind of common mind in which individuals share whenever they gain true knowledge. The materialists posited a sort of common intelligence of the race, separated from individuals. Against the materialists, Thomas defends the integrity of each individual knower. He argues that an individual's knowing and choosing are his alone. Knowing and choosing reside in the ambient core of truly spiritual being, and that domain is also the home of individual freedom.
We are masters of our own actions by reason of our being able to choose this or that. Man is said to be made to God's image, insofar as he is an intelligent being endowed with free choice and self-movement, and is the principle of his actions, having free choice and control of his actions.
Thomas devotes the longest, and many say the most original, section of his Summa to the question of human freedom and its outcome. The first half of this section is devoted to human destiny, to the actions that lead toward fulfillment or away from it. For Thomas, the meaning of an action stems primarily from the objective which calls it forth. The technical name for such an objective is the end of the action, or its finality. Commenting on Aristotle, Thomas puts it this way:
if we inquire what is the good intended in any act or any enterprise, it should be known that the good is that for whose sake all else is done. For in medicine, all is done for the sake of health. In the military art, all for the sake of victory. And in building, all for the sake of making a house. Also, in any business at all, there is an intended good for whose sake all is done. Now, this intended good in each and every work or act of choice is called the end, for the end is simply that for the sake of which all else is done.
Thomas frequently employs the maxim, every agent acts for an end. The end prompts the agent, calling but not compelling the action into being. Thomas asks whether human life has an ultimate end or finality, and what that end might be. Taking his stand with Aristotle, Thomas argues that the ultimate end of human life is happiness, though not everything that promises to contribute to happiness really does so.
If we immediately discover an end to which all that is done in the human arts and works is directed, then such an end will be the good that is worked for, absolutely. That is, it will be what is intended, at least indirectly, in all human works. But if in this matter several goods are discovered, reason must transcend this plurality until it comes to the thing itself, that is, some one thing. For man's ultimate end as man must be one by reason of the unity of human nature, just as there is one end for the medical doctor as a medical doctor because of the unity of the medical art. And this ultimate end of man as such, and not only as doctor or soldier or builder, is called the human good, which is happiness.
Now, concerning perfect happiness, Thomas finds the ultimate end of human life to be friendship with God. We pursue felicity in this life, but what alone will satisfy us completely is that face-to-face vision of God in which we share our life with God and God shares his with us. The uncertain happiness we find in this life, Thomas calls felicity. The ultimate happiness we attain in a face-to-face encounter with God, he calls beatitude. Having defined the distinctive nature of man and his capacity for thought and freedom, Thomas clarifies the proper meaning of a human act. He says that all actions are not acts. Some we do without thinking. A man scratches his beard without thinking. A woman fusses with her hair. We all digest our food and breathe normally without thinking about it. These are all actions of human beings. But what Thomas calls human acts require some degree of thought, deliberation, and choice.
Among man's acts, only those proper to man as man are properly called human actions. For it is as master of his own actions that man differs from other non-rational creatures.
Non-rational creatures, such as insects, fish, birds, and animals, are moved by instincts, by species-inherent drives and similar forces. People also have these specific drives for food, pleasure, and survival. They're given to us in our animality, but we're called to complete or perfect our humanity as responsible individuals.
So only those actions of which man is master are properly called human. Now, man is the master of his acts through his reason and will, and consequently, free choice is spoken of as the power of will and reason. Hence, acts properly called human are those that proceed from a deliberate act of will. Other actions belonging to man can certainly be spoken of as actions of man, but not properly as human actions, because they do not belong to man as man.
As the Summa Theologiae proceeds, Thomas begins a detailed examination of our passions or emotions, our habits, our virtues and vices. We share the passions with other animals as we respond to the challenges and attractions of our natural and social situation. We love or hate, we're attracted or repelled, we take delight or sorrow in our relationships. The enticements and frustrations of the good and evil in our situation move us to hope or despair, to audacious or timorous response, maybe even to anger. These emotions in themselves are neither good nor bad. They become so only in their concrete setting of freely chosen human actions. Nevertheless, the repeated experience of certain passions, coupled with repeated choices and actions, dispose a human agent to certain patterns of behavior. His conduct is directed along the lines of more or less stable actions. This stability is founded upon habits, such as a disposition to generosity or a tendency to lie. Because habits, as distinct from immediate feelings and emotions, are the product of repeatedly willed actions, we do speak of them as good or bad.
Sensory powers can be considered in two ways. First, insofar as they act from natural impulse, and second, insofar as they act under reason's rule. Insofar as they act by natural impulse, they are ordered and determined, just as nature is, to one thing or outcome. But insofar as they act under reason's rule, they can be ordered to various things. In this way, sense powers can have habits by which they are well or badly disposed towards something.
Today we usually restrict the term virtue to moral actions, but the word is broader for Thomas. A virtue is any disposition towards authentic human good, a sort of habit of doing good. Vices are habitual dispositions that tend away from good. According to Thomas, a morally virtuous man is one who acts as he ought to act with regard to God, to other people, things, and himself. A moral virtue is a habit of the mind by which we live righteously. The web of lesser specific virtues hangs upon the chief or cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. Thomas distinguishes the cardinal virtues according to the faculty within us that each is meant to strengthen and guide.
There are four subjects of the virtue of which we now speak, namely, the power which is rational in its essence, and this is perfected by prudence, and that which is rational by participation, and is threefold: the will, the subject of justice; the power of desire, the subject of temperance; and the power of resistance, the subject of fortitude.
The life of grace depends on the theological virtues, the gifts of faith, hope, and charity.
In relation to both intellect and will, man needs to receive, in addition to the natural virtues, something supernatural to direct him to a supernatural end. First, as regards the intellect, man receives certain supernatural principles, which are held by means of a divine light, and these are the things which are to be believed, and this virtue is faith. Secondly, the will is directed to this end, both as to the movement of intention, which tends to that end as something attainable, this pertains to hope, and as to a certain spiritual union, whereby the will is, in a way, transformed into that end, and this belongs to charity or love.
Thomas also discusses the counterparts of virtue, the vices, which include uncaring ignorance, sloth, negligence, injustice, and malice.
Three things are found to be contrary to virtue. One of these is sin, which is opposed to virtue in respect of that to which virtue is directed, namely, the good. For, properly speaking, sin denotes a disordered act, even as an act of virtue is an ordered and fitting act. While in respect of that which belongs to the essence of virtue directly, its contrary is vice, because the vice of a thing seems to consist in its not being disposed in a way fitting its nature.
Throughout the Summa, Thomas speaks of man and God, but the communal nature of his thought is evident all along. Human society is situated within the community of beings, but whereas nature is a domain of more or less determined laws, the free character of human association calls for its own kind of law and government.
Man is, by nature, a social animal. Now, a social life cannot exist among a number of people unless someone presides, who is to look after the common good. For many, as such, seek many things, whereas one attends only to one. That is why Aristotle says that wherever many things are directed to one end, we shall always find someone at the head directing them.
Near the beginning of his treatise on law, Thomas asks whether law is an affair of reason. In answering, he formulates a famous definition:
law is nothing other than a reasonable directive, directing beings toward the common good, promulgated by the one who has the care of the community.
In discussing God's providence in the first part of the Summa, Thomas made a related point.
The whole community of the universe is governed by the divine reason. Therefore, the very notion of the government of things in God, the ruler of the universe, has the nature of a law. And since the divine reason's conception of things is not subject to time, but is eternal, therefore, this kind of law must be called eternal.
He then develops three subordinate kinds of law from the eternal law. There's natural law, which is inherent in the kind of beings humans are. There's human law, which is what we normally mean by the kind of positive law that legislatures pass and courts pass upon. And there's divine law, the revealed law, the old law of the Old Testament, and the new law of the gospel. Natural law tends to remain general and implicit. Human and divine laws are intended to provide more detailed guidance and complete the fabric of social directives. Thomas also puts the question whether there is in us a natural law. He gets his answer from eternal law, based on the idea that human reason participates in God's providence.
Now, among all others, the rational creature is subject to divine providence in a more excellent way, insofar as it itself partakes of a share of providence, by being provident both for itself and for others. Therefore, it has a share of the eternal reason, whereby it has a natural inclination to its appropriate activity and end. And this partaking of the eternal law in the rational creature is called natural law.
Thomas knows that different peoples have different customs, but he also upholds the notion that human nature is commonly shared and that human needs are everywhere similar. So the philosopher's task, then, is to identify and describe the fundamental ways in which we do good and avoid evil. Thomas believes we are called to follow God's intention that we do good and avoid evil. These basic directives written into the very heart of man are the primary precepts of natural law. Thomas says that in natural law, there's first a general directive to preserve ourselves. This command holds for groups as well as for individuals.
The order of the precepts of the natural law is the same as the order of our natural inclinations. For there is in man a primary and natural inclination to good, which he has in common with all things, inasmuch as everything desires the preservation of its own being according to its nature.
Thomas continues,
there is in man a second inclination to more specific ends, according to the nature he has in common with other animals. According to this inclination, those things are said to belong to natural law, which nature has taught all animals. Instincts such as the joining of husband and wife, the education of children, and so forth.
The human character of Thomas's examples may surprise us, but it reminds us that even our animal tendencies are part of our human nature. They fall under the law of human nature. Of course, there's also the natural human tendency to follow the dictates of reason.
Third, there is in man an inclination to good according to the nature of his reason, and this is proper to man alone. Thus, man has a natural inclination to know the truth about God and to live in society. And in this regard, whatever belongs to this inclination comes under the natural law, as, for example, to shun ignorance and to avoid offending those with whom one has to live and other similar things associated with such an inclination.
From these primary precepts of natural law, other more definite directives can be formulated. Many of them are embodied in proverbs, sayings, and maxims, but humans also need particular rules to guide them towards the good of the common life. This is the domain of positive human law. While recognizing the benefits of human law, Thomas also recognizes its limitations. As to whether human laws ought to prohibit all vices, he says,
the human law ought not to prohibit all those vices from which the virtuous abstain, but only the more serious ones from which the majority may be expected to abstain, and above all, those which are harmful to others and which threaten the continued existence of society itself, such as murder, theft, and the like.
But Thomas cautions that the governing power is not the private preserve of anyone.
Law, properly speaking, has as its first and foremost purpose the ordering of the common good. Now, to order anything to the common good belongs either to the whole people or to someone who is delegated to act on their behalf. Hence, the making of a law belongs either to the whole people or to a public personage who has responsibility for the whole people.
How should political and legal power be structured? Thomas favors a mixed polity of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy.
Everyone should have some part in the sovereignty. In this way, the peace of the people is preserved, and everyone loves and protects such an arrangement. Hence, the best system of government is found in a state or kingdom in which one person is placed in authority to preside over all in accord with virtue. Then under him are others ruling in accord with virtue. Yet such a government belongs to all, both because they can be elected out of all and because they are also elected by all. Indeed, such is the best government, well formed by a mixture of kingship, in the sense that one person presides, and aristocracy, in the sense that many rule virtuously, and democracy, in the sense that leaders can be elected from among the populace, and further, that the choice of the leadership belongs to the people.
Here Thomas rationally justifies the structure of legitimate authority, and he also describes how we should seek the good of the whole community. For example, sedition stirs up division and rebellion, and Thomas agrees it's a grave evil. But if there's a tyranny, he says that rebellion is not seditious.
The rule of a tyrant is unjust because it is directed not to the common good, but to the private good of the ruler. Therefore, the overthrow of this kind of government does not have the character of sedition, unless perhaps it produces such disorder that the society under the tyrant suffers greater harm from the resulting disturbance than from the tyrant's rule. Rather, it is the tyrant who is guilty of sedition, because he spreads discord and division among the people under him, so as to control them more securely. It is characteristic of a tyranny that it is directed to the personal interest of the ruler and to the harm of the community.
Interestingly, Thomas's concern for the common good is nowhere clearer than in his defense of private property. He finds that taking a moderate profit is reasonable, and he explains why it's best that individuals acquire, own, control, and dispose of private property. But then he turns from the right to possess property to discussing the question of use. Here he differs.
Each man should not hold external things for his own use, but for the good of the community, so that each one should readily share things with others in need.
And further,
what belongs to human law cannot cancel what is required either by natural law or by divine law. Now, according to the natural order founded by divine providence, material things are ordered to the alleviation of human needs. Therefore, the division and ownership of things ordained by human law must not interfere with the alleviation of human needs by means of those things. And so, whatever a man has in superabundance is owed of natural right to the poor for their sustenance.
Thomas places the primary obligation on the judgment of the individual who has resources, but he says that an endangered person might take what he needs without committing fraud or robbery.
If, however, there is such urgent and obvious need that there is clearly an immediate emergency for sustenance, as when any person is immediately endangered and without means of alleviation, then he may legitimately take from another person's goods what he needs, either openly or secretly. Nor is this, strictly speaking, fraud or robbery.
In particular social issues, Thomas, like every great thinker, is in part bound by his times and in part not. Many of his views on how Christian believers should relate to unbelievers and heretics were accepted in their time. They're simply unacceptable today. For example, he was concerned with regulating the dress of the Jews, but he opposed those who would force Jews to convert to Christianity.
The practice of the church never held that the children of Jews should be baptized against the will of their parents. Therefore, it seems dangerous to bring forward this new view that, contrary to the previously established custom of the church, the children of Jews should be baptized against the will of their parents.
Thomas says that religious conversion cannot be forced because faith cannot be forced. Here he includes Gentiles, mostly Muslims, in his argument.
Unbelievers, such as the Gentiles and the Hebrews who have never accepted the Christian faith, should in no way be forced to believe, for faith is a matter of the free will.
Thomas accepts slavery and serfdom, but limits the obedience enjoined by these institutions.
The inferior is not obliged to obey his superior when the latter commands something in matters where he is without authority, for all men are equal by nature. Hence, in the contracting of matrimony or making a vow of chastity or such things, servants are not obliged to obey their masters, nor children their parents. But in what has to do with the appropriate disposition of human actions and dealings, a subject is obliged to obey his superiors in the sectors of their superiority or authority, just as a soldier obeys his general in matters of war, a servant his master in the tasks assigned him, a son his father in matters included in the discipline and management of family life, and matters of this sort.
Thomas's views regarding women also are limited by the social conditions of his own time. Yet here, too, he seeks a reasonable basis for the relation between the sexes. Women were totally dependent in the society he knew, yet Thomas remarks in another work that husbands have obligations, too.
If a husband were permitted to abandon his wife, the society of husband and wife would not be an association of equals, but instead a sort of slavery on the part of the wife.
But Thomas says marriage is an association of equals for the following reason.
The image of God is common to both sexes, since it resides in the mind, where there is no distinction of sexes.
In the unfinished third part of Thomas's Summa Theologiae, as well as in the second half of the second part, the topics and arguments become more directly theological. Church fathers, church councils, papal writings, and canon law become more prominent. Aristotle is never forgotten, but St. Augustine and other religious writers come to Thomas's assistance as he thinks his way through Christ to the divine Trinity as the end and source of human life. The Summa traces out the great circle by which all of creation proceeds from God and returns to Him, from eternity, through time, to eternity again. Thomas's own thought is caught up in that circle. He observes,
through will and love, a person is somehow drawn into the very things willed and loved.
One of the most original modern interpreters of St. Thomas, Étienne Gilson, describes Thomas's lifelong search to understand, and in his understanding, to love.
It is not necessarily in the silence of a cell, nor in the turmoil of a university chair. It is not even necessarily under the vault of a church. It can also be on the road to Naples that the presence of Thomas can be felt. For myself, I never discover him anywhere so well as on the extreme point of one of those Italian promontories, those sun-beaten rocks whose every crack sustains fresh and green vegetation, and which St. Thomas Aquinas more than once beheld from the shore of the Tyrrhenian Sea. The time is noon. The brilliant sun of a May day sets everything in clear and sharp relief, like the definition of an exacting intellect. Near at hand, everything lies revealed in the clear evidence of its essence and enjoys the peace of its order. Farther off, the glance of the eye moves toward distances so brilliant that they are lost in their own expanse and disappear in the very excess of the light that covers them. What is more beautiful than this earth on which the source of distinctions is the very same as that of unity? Suspended between the heavens and the sea, some birds look down upon it from on high and glide like angels, until one of them, moving off with a great sweep of wings, answers the call of the sun, mounts, and, cutting the blue with his flight and his cry, rises to meet the light.
During the last weeks of his life, Thomas gave up writing the Soma. His secretary and companion, Reginald, was especially insistent one day that the master complete his greatest undertaking. To his dismay, Thomas answered,
"Reginald, I am unable to do it."
Pressed further, Thomas refused again.
"Reginald, I can't, because all that I have written seems like chaff to me."
Reginald was still insistent. A generally reliable biographer, one of Thomas's intimate associates, tells us that he reluctantly gave his reason.
"All that I have written seems like chaff to me in comparison with the things that I have seen and that have been shown to me."
Thomas had come to the end of his life, but not without hope, for he'd written,
"What is unknown cannot be loved. But it does not follow that knowledge is the same as love, since love is the goal of knowledge. And so love takes up where knowledge leaves off."
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of St. Thomas Aquinas by Knowledge Products. The script for this presentation is by Kenneth L. Schmitz, Professor of Philosophy Emeritus and Fellow of Trinity College, University of Toronto. The script is edited by Professor John Locks of Vanderbilt University and Mike Hassel of Knowledge Products. Produced by Pat Childs. Vocal characterizations are by
Dan Church, Rob Daniel, Travis Hardison, Cecil Jones, Joe Keenan, John Sherberg, and Robert Wynn.
Music is by Ralph Childs. Recorded at Fred Jones Recording Services and Archer Productions. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1990 by Carmichael & Carmichael Incorporated. This presentation of The Giants of Philosophy is a part of the Audio Classics series, a continuing series of cassettes presenting the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context.